Sie hören eine Veranstaltung der Leipziger Buchmesse. Für die Inhalte ist die Leipziger Buchmesse nicht verantwortlich. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
A little time when I was younger, I worked in below Stuttgart in the engineering, and then I worked a little time for Lufthansa in Hamburg. And a big difference between Ireland and Germany is the early mornings. In Ireland, it is not possible to do this at 10:30 in the morning. The Irish and the Germans, we like football and music and beer. but we don't like the mornings. This is different in Germany. In Germany, you start early, and we don't. So, but we will do our best. There is something broken in us, the human animal, perhaps not so much broken as unfixed. And this unfixed thing is the identifying of who we are through an us and a them. And the us and them thinking is the cause of all war. This is a story about an Irish boy, and it is the story of Ireland. But it isn't just the story about an Irish boy. It isn't just the story of Ireland. It's the story of the human animal. It's the story of cause. It's the story of the choice to fight, to go to war, and to kill. And it is nearly always boys. Not always, nearly always. Principles. I was 6 years old when I watched a gun go into Dad's mouth. Another would think that was the beginning of the whole thing, like it has to have one. Another would think that's what made me what I am. I'm not so sure. There were other incidents too. Another would call these pivotal events. Another would, I don't. I just think some of us are made this way. I had it all worked out. Okay, maybe not all of it. But I knew what my role was, what sacrifices needed to be made, what needed to be done, what I needed to do. Another would wonder about my role and about the how and the why. That's fair enough. We are a curious animal. I don't know if I could give an answer, like wrap it up in a there you go so bundle. War isn't like that, not when you actually do it. But there is them, and there is us, and there is homeland, and that is the cause of the conflict. Anyhow, I had it all worked out, and then she came, and everything is not where it was. 8 days. That's how long I've known her. Mad, but that's what girls do. They wreck your head. She just came out of nowhere. I mean, not really nowhere, but she wasn't part of it, and now she is, like she was always there. Even when I'm thinking of something else, she is there, and that's not good when you do what I do. When nothing must be in my head but the gun and the bullet and the kill, but she is in my head, like now, and just then as I left my room, and all morning, and before that when I woke early and there was nothing for it but to lie there with her, well, not physically with her, replaying those first conversations with her, extending the reel here and there, redrafting, inventing. I'm unable to think of anything else. Only the girl will do. And you know something? I'm happy with it. I hear her voice, as if her face and body were not torture enough, and I'm thinking of her as I step from the house into the bright morning. I tidy the fall of my overcoat and pull up my blue scarf. The dog slides in alongside, and I'm roughing my hand across his head as I reach the end of the drive, where the gate is closed, tied with an old shoelace. The gate is low, and with one hand on the top bar, I'm stepping over it when I hear the porch door slide behind me. Your mother asks if you'll pick up this on the world on the way back. I turn. It's my dad. He is standing in the porch with one hand holding the sliding door. I lob a protest over the low gate. I'm not buying trashy newspapers. I shake my head at the dog, and he barks once, as if he agrees. I look to the house where Dad, now retreated from the midday air, relays the refusal down the central hallway, and there he stands, nodding with his big, dopey smile, as he absorbs a long reply from the kitchen at the far end. I mean, the whole show is pure theatre. She says, "You won't be wanting dinner then," he summarizes, his head re-emerging into the sunshine. This is Dad all over. He finds the middle ground and plays for loose change. I look on a face that is held wide open to catch my answer. He knows he has me. "Fair enough," I say. "This underworld it is. Well, sometimes you just have to lose, and to lose fast." "That's great," he replies. "I love to see a man stick to his principles." And he laughs. "Well, I get you anything," I ask him. "What are you getting yourself?" "The Times and the Tribune." "Pick us up the Indo, will you? And the People, if there's any left." "Sure, Dad. No bother." "Right you are, son. Right you are," he calls from the porch as I set off on the short walk to the late morning mass. It is Sunday. It is April. It is 1990. Sorry. The dinner. "Will I pour you tea? Are you going to the match, son? Did you shift last night, Johnny?" "I've joined Mam, Dad and Anna at the kitchen table for Sunday dinner. Please, I might go up for the second half." "I'm sure you didn't," I answer, moving my cup across the table to within Mam's reach. "Thanks. Where's the other fella?" "Declan was away early," Mam answers, pouring the tea. "Peter collected him. Off to the Mourne Mountains, if you don't mind. Up at the crack of dawn he was, making sandwiches. I had to hide the good ham." I don't say anything. My two brothers often take weekend mountain hikes. It is a harmless enough activity, I guess, but they can get puritanical about it. If you want to listen to them going on and on and on and on about it, as if not doing it with the voice of the devil himself. It's a type of thing people do to help them feel better about themselves. I understand that. "They'll be here later with Yon One," Mam continues, Yon One being Aunt Anna. "I'm doing a pot of homemade soup." An old pot rattles on the cooker behind her. "Well, Johnny, spill the beans," Anta persists. "Did you?" "And a brown bread in the oven," Mam says, continuing the account of her preparations for high tea. "It should be good," Dad insists. "Derry will bring a great crowd." "I'd say you did. Who was she, Johnny boy? Do I know her?" Anna probes again. "Hey, Nosy Parker, eat up," Mam says, "and eat them sprouts. They're good for you." "I don't like them myself, but I eat them." I look across to my sister. "Yes, Anna, come on, get them into you. There's a good girl." Anna Donnelly is 20 years old. She's a good-looking girl. Well, she is my sister. She has long, dark hair the colour of old oak and green eyes, forest green, fading to an edge of azure blue. She has the same eyes as her brother, the brother who's sitting across the table from her. With the minimum of months between us, Anna and I had a shared childhood, and for all our young years, we were often mistaken for twins. Through threads of our long hair, she gives me a warning. "I might take a walk up for the second half myself," Dad says with some finality, and he rises. With his knife, he pushes the scraps off the plate into a bowl set aside for the dog, and he carries the plate to the worktop. "I'll wash them for you later, Kathleen," he says, after we read of the papers. I also rise. I throw on some eggs, Mam says, to no one other than herself. I could do a bit of a salad. She too rises and begins to clear the table. I follow Dad to the living room and sit on the couch. With a newspaper in hand, I can hear the opening lines of a familiar tune as Mam sings as she works. She is singing Lizzie Lindsay. "If she ever got her hands on Danny Doyle, I'd have been given the door," Dad says from behind his newspaper. "I think we'll all have got the door," I say, laughing. I can't remember a day when I have not heard Mam singing a Danny Doyle song. As I settle on the couch, a girl arrives at the back door, lets herself in, makes her way to the living room and jumps up beside me. "Katrina Begley is calling me names again," she sighs. "Hello, Clara," Dad says without lowering his newspaper. "Hello, Oliver," she tugs at my arm. I drop my reading and look to her. Clara Mulligan is 7 years old and the youngest child of a neighbouring family. The Mulligans run a bar in the town centre and Clara's parents are too busy with work to be busy at home. Mam has taken on the job of childminding during and after school hours, school holidays and weekends. Clara has known more childminding than she has parenting, and she is adopted here as home and me as big brother, and that's okay with me. "Don't worry, baby. She's probably just mad jealous," I say, putting my arm around her. "Because she's fat?" "No," I laugh. "Probably because you've a handsome big brother like me, and all she has is that Begley to look at. A brother with a face like that would upset anyone. He's not allowed past the creamery, that fella, in case he turn all the milk sour." "That's true. That's it, isn't it?" "Indeed it is. If I had to look at that ugly contortion every day, I wouldn't be too happy either." "Okie dokie," Clara says, leaping off the couch. "I'm going to tell her that." "There she goes," Dad says. I watch the girl skip out the door and I look over to my father. Dad can spend a large part of any day behind a newspaper, and I'm never sure when he's beyond those pages whether he's reading at all or he's just taken cover to drift off to some private other world. I ponder on him for a while as he sits and reads, but sometimes it is impossible for me to think about Dad and to not remember the gun. I don't have a good memory for most stuff, like what they try to teach you at school. I learn things and to go in and linger a while, but they never stay any distance. It seems I can only hold on to the peculiar. I could never have been a great student, despite my teacher's hopes. And I don't remember much of my early childhood, the first 5 or 6 years ago, but I do remember the gun. It must have been winter, because it was dark and wet and cold. We were on our way home from an afternoon shopping in Newry. Mam has a thing about shopping in Newry. She says everything up there is great value. As it leaves the town, the road from Newry to Dundalk climbs a big hill. Near the beginning of this hill, there is a junction where the main road continues south and where a smaller road runs east along the coast of Carlingford Lough and then south along the peninsula into Dundalk Bay. The seashore route is a nice drive on a nice day. Dad had a habit of calling out to us kids in the back as we approached this junction, "Turn or straight on?" We always shouted "turn" because the longer coastal road offered something of an adventure. Most times, Dad drove on anyway, whatever the vote, but once in a while, to keep the magic in the game, he turned. There was just Anna and I with them that day in the car. I guess the two older boys were at home with Aunt Hannah, and we shouted, "Turn, turn, turn." I don't know why Dad turned. It was too dark to see anything off the drive, but maybe he fancied the spin, or maybe he was in some sort of a comfortable daydream and he needed the extra mileage. Whatever the reason, it was a bad choice. The road we took runs next to the Newry Canal on a narrow strip between the Broaden and Lough and the dark rise of the Cooley Mountains. 4 miles from Newry, the road crosses the border into the Republic of Ireland. There is a customs post on the southern side, and sometimes the police or army security check on the north. Somewhere between Newry and the border, Dad suddenly slowed. I tried to look ahead between the two front seats, but it was difficult to see anything in the dark and in the rain. Then I saw the slow arc of a lamp being waved. Mam and Dad's conversation died abruptly, and in the new silence I could hear Dad's breathing as he stopped the car and wound down his window, his hand slipping once from the handle. It wasn't the first time we'd been stopped on a trip to Newry, and I sat quietly in the back with Anna as Dad passed his license out to the soldier and answered questions about who we were and what we were doing. The soldier told Dad to get out and go to the rear of the car and open the boot. I heard the boot opening with the sound of muffled voices. There was silence and waiting. Then another soldier stooped through Dad's door and pointed a gun at Mam and shouted for us all to get out of the car. And he stood by the side of the road with his gun still pointing at Mam. And we watched in the cold rain as two other soldiers searched the inside of the car. The first soldier was questioning Dad at the rear of the car as the search came to some kind of an end and we cowered in the wet darkness as Dad lifted Mam's scattered shopping from the road and he put it back into the car. Dad closed the boot, trying to lock it, but he couldn't get the key into the catch. The first soldier pushed him towards the driver's door and the second soldier marched the rest of us to the car and he shouted for us to get in and get the fuck out. Even as a 6-year-old boy, I thought this to be an odd instruction. Dad was fumbling and struggling to get the car going again, and after only a few yards, the car stalled. Dad was breathing loudly, shaking the steering wheel with a tightening grip as if he was trying to force the engine by will and panic alone. It was then that the thing happened. Thinking on it later, I know that the soldier must have run from the ditch, but at the time, it seemed as if the gun appeared from the dark air. Dad's window was still fully opened, and the first thing we all saw was the big black gun as it caught Dad on the side of his head. I heard Mam scream, and behind me, in the back with Anna, she gripped my left arm and froze. I saw Dad recover from the knock, but as he turned to the window, I watched the gun go into his mouth. The sound in the car was Dad's gulping for air. The next words were very clear, "I'm going to kill you." There was a long silence before the gun disappeared back out of the window. Dad didn't move. Mam still stared straight ahead, and Anna was still frozen. The silence went on forever. Then a head appeared at the window and leant in and retreated, and I heard voices and laughter. "Pissed his fucking pants, mate," I heard the soldier say. "Pissed his fucking pants." Just Dad just sat there, his head dropped and his body slumped, and turned away from the window as other heads gathered at the car and shouted at us, "Get going, drive away now, move it, Paddy Pisspants." The shouting and the laughing went on and on and on and on as Dad remained slumped in his seat. Mam was leaning over to him, her hand cradling his face as his shoulders shook. "Oh, Oliver," she said, but he didn't respond and he didn't make any move to restart the car. Mam got out into the shouting and laughing and took Dad out and walked him around the front of the car to her seat before going back to the driver's side and wiping the seat with the cloth that Dad used to clean the windows. Not once did Mam look at the soldiers. Then she sat in the car and she drove away into the south. "The children," was all Dad said, and Mam shushed him with a touch and we travelled home in silence. But I knew that one day I would take a big black gun to those soldiers. A black flag flying. It is the second week of May, and it is 2 weeks since that first evening with Cora Flannery. 2 weeks, I am nervous. Today I'm to call at her house for the first time. Today I shall meet her mam and dad. I've held out for as long as I can, but Cora says that I'm really pushing it, that at 2 weeks I'm just being plain weird. What can I say? There is normal time, and there is Cora's time, and well... I tie the low gate closed behind me with the shoelace and salute Dad, who stands watching me from the front porch. "All right, son," he calls. "All right, Dad." Next door in the front garden of an identical house, a small man is bent low at work among some rushes and shrubs. "She has you on your knees again." "Eddie," I comment. He barely looks up. Gobshite. It's just a whisper, but I catch it. And too late he tries to run. Too late and too slow. Before he can get going, I've cleared the wall and I have him in a firm grip. Eddie Reynolds is my uncle. He is ex-army, and he is a small man, but he is a proud man. He was, in his youth, the boxing champion of Leinster, and he held that title for 5 years. Eddie and Hannah are my mam's brother and sister, and they live next door. The three of them do everything together, shopping, socialising, holidays, the whole fruit basket, and the rest of the time they give out about each other. Eddie and Hannah never married, and neither one has children. When Eddie retired from the army, he took me as his vocation, and many of his afternoons were spent teaching me boxing, arm-to-arm combat, and, removed from the eyes of others, how to handle a gun. Eddie delighted in the telling of tales of army life, the barracks, the rifle range, the border, the Kura, the Congo, and the Lebanon. I loved to hear those stories. Back then, Eddie could manage me, but that was 10 years ago, when Eddie was 50 and I was 9. This is now, and it is no longer a contest. Gobshite, is it? In one movement, I lift the small man up to my shoulders and spin him around. "Johnny," Eddie pleads as he tries to fight my hold. "Let me down, you fecker." But I hold him easy enough. "Hannah, Hannah," Eddie calls out. Aunt Hannah appears in the central doorway. She takes no notice of the scene at play in the front lawn. She turns to Dad, who still stands in the open front porch. "A beautiful day, Oliver," she calls. "A beautiful day, Hannah. Thank God, a beautiful day." He looks up to a pencil grey clouds that move below a blue and white sky, though we could see a shower yet. "How's herself?" Aunt Hannah asks. "Right as rain, Hannah," Dad says, indicating over his shoulder. In the brief silence of his pausing, a few faint notes of song escape the hallway. "She's right as rain." I let Eddie down and have cleared the wall before he steadies and takes a swipe. "Too slow, you old fox," I call, pulling the coat straight. I take the bicycle from where it rests against the front wall, check the tires for hardness, mount, and I'm off. I look as I go. The old soldier waves, acknowledges Dad with a salute, gives his sister a shake of his head, and returns to his garden low among the roses. I cycle out of the small estate and turn west into the Remparts Road. I pass the grounds of the lawn tennis club where on Sunday mornings Anna and I would climb over the wall for a game before the caretaker arrived and threw us out. I turn north to Distillery Lane and then west again through Jocelyn Street, passing the often of a local newspaper below the first floor snooker rooms of the Catholic Young Man Society, where Eamon and I played every week while the rest of the class took to the cold and windy sports field. At the junction with Chapel Street, I passed the home bakery where Mam queues on a Saturday morning for 2 French loaves and an almond ring, and every so often a chocolate or pineapple cake. I pass St. Patrick's Cathedral and continue through Crow Street, passing the town hall. I continue along the side wall of the courthouse and enter the market square. It was here I sat with Cora just 2 weeks ago. And it was here, in this square, where I first took notice of politics, first made conclusions on the story of Ireland, and first decided my role. That was 1981, and I was 10 years old. Bobby Sands, an IRA prisoner in a British jail in Northern Ireland, died after 66 days of a hunger strike. He was 27 years old. 9 other men would follow him that summer on a demand for identity, a demand to be recognized as political prisoners. The streets and the television stations were full of it. The newspapers were full of it. Mam and Dad's talk at the kitchen table and neighbors' talk over fences was full of it. The walls, hoardings, bridges, everything around town were full of it. The list of the prisoners' 5 demands was everywhere, with smash H block below them as a sign-off. At the time, I wondered why a people with so little against an enemy with so much would put all this effort into a battle for clothes and for prison visits, a battle that could never affect the war. I asked my dad what was going on. Politics, he said. It's all a game of politics. A protest base was established in the market square throughout the Bobby Sands hunger strike, and every day on the way home from school, I walked through it to try to catch some of the fever. I didn't. I just couldn't figure the thing out. The black flags appeared on the day he died. They hung from every lamppost. That day, a skinny teenage girl in tight jeans and a tight haircut asked me to sign a petition. Why? I asked, and the question seemed to throw her. It didn't make sense to me. My 10-year-old head just couldn't figure it out. Bobby Sands had contested a Westminster seat during his hunger strike, and he had won. Graffiti on an old wall near the school read, "The Right Honourable Bobby Sands." I looked at that wall every day. The Right Honourable Bobby Sands MP. Why, I thought, are we celebrating participation in the very thing that has persecuted us all this time? But celebration it was. Bobby Sands MP was everywhere. There were riots in the north when he died. We watched it all on the television. Women blowing whistles and banging lids on the pavements. Youths attacking armoured police cars, police lines behind riot shields, and petrol bombs flying in the night. The funeral was like a state affair, a long cortege of tens of thousands, a colour party, and shots into the air, and everyone had something to say about it. A week later, after 59 days in hunger strike, Francis Hughes died. He was 25, so the whole thing was repeated. And then another hunger striker died, and then another, and then another, and then another. It seemed to go on forever. In the Republic, though everyone was gripped by it and concerned, we were yet distanced, like kind of detached, as though it were remote and happening in another country altogether. We sat as spectators in our living rooms, as bin lids rattled in the mornings, stones were launched in the afternoons, and petrol bombs flew at night. We watched the long funeral processions, the stiff-stepped coffin carrion and the colour parties shooting bullets up into a sky that had never harmed Ireland. And here in Dundalk, the black flags hung in the market square. 10 men were dead by the time it finished. I asked Dad, why did it stop? Politics, he said. It's all a game of politics. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. But Dad was right. It was only ever politics, and we lost. And we Irish were too used to losing. We're too fond of celebrating moral defeats, too fond of celebrating small victories that are not victories at all and do not matter, too fond of suffering, too fond of martyrs, too fond of the damned word struggle, and too fond of reverting to plain politics with the British, who have a long history of never doing us any good. The only thing that matters in this war is removing the enemy from Ireland, and to this end, the hunger strikes change nothing. They were an attempt at persuasion. But why bother? The only battle worth fighting is a battle that can help win this war. That was a lesson I learned in 1981. A single black flag was erected in the lane near the school during the hunger strike and was forgotten and left in place when all the others were taken down. For years, I watched that flag as it faded and tore until one day the wood gave way to rot and it fell to the ground, where the cleaning truck brushed it up and dumped it along with all the other unwanted things.
This was good one.
Have I more time?
No.
Is it finished?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ich kann mir vorstellen, dass es nicht ganz einfach war zu folgen, aber Sie haben bestimmt mitbekommen, was für eine dramatische Geschichte das ist. Für jemanden, der ein bisschen älter ist, das ist 30 Jahre her und das ist ganz in der Nähe gewesen. Und was uns so ergriffen hat, ist, dass ein junger, ganz normaler Junge, der in der Familie lebt, der ganz normal aufgrund dieses dramatischen Erlebnisses, dieser Demütigung seines Vaters, sich entscheidet zu töten. Vielleicht haben Sie einen Lehrer dabei, das wäre jetzt kein Beispiel für Ihren Lehrer, sein Lehrer bildet ihn aus mit der Waffe, er wird ein Scharfschütze, wird der allerbeste Scharfschütze und er schießt ab seinem 16. Lebensjahr in manchen Nächten britische Soldaten. Einfach, weil er mit 6 Jahren auf diese Schiene sich gesetzt hat und davon nie mehr wegkam. Sein kleines Problem ist, dass er sich in Cora Flannery verliebt und das ist eine wunderbare Liebesgeschichte und die wirft natürlich die Frage auf, was mache ich? Gehe ich diesem Plan nach, den ich geschworen habe, zu folgen? Oder liebe ich einfach nur? Und das ist der Anfang der Geschichte, die dann noch sehr, sehr, sehr dramatisch weitergeht. Ich bedanke mich oder wir bedanken uns für die Aufmerksamkeit. Haben Sie eine wunderbare Messe, wer das Buch kaufen will? Irgendwo ist es hier erhältlich. Haben Sie noch einen schönen Tag. Danke.
It's just here somewhere. Yeah, yes. I'll be here. I'm doing another meeting tomorrow. So, a longer one, I think. This morning.
Or the morning.
And are you from the border?
I'm from the border, so it's actually south. Right on. It's a bit like the German war. They have the towers.
Sure.
You know, the towers. So even though we're in the south there, I have the house for a long distance. So.
Jack Glass, yeah, I read from James Bond's travels.
Yes.
He came to our recent journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not really from any... it is from a perspective, but what I try to do is to tell the story, but not tell an opinion. So I really put the reader to form his opinions. His own opinion. I don't promote a philosophy. I just tell the story of how and why. How is it possible for somebody who's really sweet, who's a young man, very, very intelligent, very sort of...
Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir sehen uns auf der nächsten Leipziger Buchmesse.